Welcome to Mortification of Spin, a casual conversation about things that count, with Carl Truman and Todd Pruitt, a podcast of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Let's join this week's conversation.
Welcome to Mortification of Spin. My name's Carl Truman. I teach at Grove City College in beautiful Western Pennsylvania. And I'm here as always with my co-host, the Reverend Todd Pruitt, pastor of Covenant Presbyterian Church in Harrisonburg, Virginia, in the equally beautiful Shenandoah Valley.
Indeed.
And we're delighted today to have a returning guest and a new guest who have just published a very significant volume on an extremely important topic. Two guests are Neil Shenvey. Neil is well known for his online writings about critical race theory. He has an AB in chemistry from Princeton and a PhD in theoretical chemistry from UC Berkeley. He's the author of Why Believe? A Reasoned Approach to Christianity, and is widely recognized for his writings on critical theory. And along with Neil, we have Pat Sawyer. Pat has a BA in psychology from UNC Chapel Hill and an MA in communication studies from UNC Greensboro and a PhD in educational studies and cultural studies from UNC Greensboro. And he's a faculty member at UNC Greensboro and has been published in the Academy and various popular outlets. And they together have co-authored a book entitled Critical Dilemma: The Rise of Critical Theories and Social Justice Ideology, Implications for the Church and Society. Great to have you with us, Neil and Pat.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, Todd.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to those of us of a certain vintage, i.e. who did our college studies in the 1980s, last few years have been remarkable. I remember in the 1980s, I did a classics degree, and we covered certain aspects of critical theory, particularly the sort of classical stuff coming out of the Frankfurt School, as part of the ancient history dimension of my degree. But really, critical theory in those days seemed to be, I would say, somewhat passé. It was, it was interesting. It had a few insights, but it didn't arouse any strong emotions either in the men that I heard teaching it or in those of us who were on the receiving end of it. And indeed, I had a student a few years ago who went to University of Edinburgh and did a PhD on Max Horkheimer. And dropped me a note, I think about 3 years ago, to say, wow, I thought I did a PhD of sort of historical interest. Now I find I've written on the hottest topic of the day. I don't want to ask why you wrote the book. That's always the cliched way to start these kind of interviews. So, but why do you think critical theory or the family of approaches that we typically bracket together that under critical theory have suddenly become the common currency, not just of obscure literature and history professors in academic, university, humanities departments, but the common currency of Twitter, the common currency of blogs, the common currency of many people who, if we put it bluntly, have never read any of the original sources and yet have a passionate interest in it. Now, why critical theory? Why now?
Great question. So critical theory, as you know, originated with the Frankfurt School in the 1920s and 30s in Germany. And that we would almost argue that the Frankfurt School is almost passé today. If you see it, it'll be a footnote on someone's text on critical theory. But I think critical theory as a broader tradition really got a shot in the arm in the late 80s, early 90s with two things. One is the advent of critical race theory in the late 80s, early 90s. And the second is with the rise of queer theory in the early 90s. So those two disciplines, which fall under the broad category of critical theory, really reinvigorated the discipline, I'd argue. And if you read the theorists themselves, they will affirm that critical theory today really experienced a renaissance in the 2000s and 2010s, as it moved from this, like you said, purely abstract theory in the ivory tower into applied, maybe even a weaponized critical theory that you see in today's social justice activism. And I really would trace the advent of critical theory, maybe the the viral incident, the leaking of the lab leak to the rise of Black Lives Matter in 2014, 2015. That's really what mainline critical theory, or all those terms like intersectionality, white privilege, white fragility, into the mainline cultural consciousness.
Yeah, and I would just add that the combination of the civil unrest that was taking place, that has been taking place relative to Black men that have been killed, and the pronounced media attention on that civil unrest, combined with the advent of Trump. And that combination has really kind of add fuel to this fire of identity politics that was already in play. So all this has stoked a stronger awareness of these ideas, you know, truncated forms of critical social theory showing up in critical social justice or anti-racism or woke culture, all these things combined together. And then the reality of social mediated platforms and the explosion of social media over the last 10 to 15 years has also added to this. So you can watch TikTok for an hour and get an education on downstream ideas of critical social theory. Obviously, truncated forms and even distorted forms in certain ways, but it is so in the water at this point. And then piggybacking on what Neil said, I think we're going to see the mantle shifting from critical race theory to queer theory in terms of what's going to be happening in culture on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that at the heart of critical theory, and this goes back to the Frankfurt School, is a war on categories. It's a war on stable categories, which really means queer theory. I won't say it's the end of the line, because you know, as long as you can say it is the worst, it is not the worst.
Right.
Queer theory seems in some ways more consistently destabilizing than critical race theory.
I was just going to ask you all, I'm sitting here with three men who've written on this. Carl has a book that's off to the publishers that's going to deal with basically kind of the history of the development of the ideas, and you all deal with this really well in your book also. And just a word to the listeners, I think that Pat and Neil do an excellent job of covering a thick topic with a broad scope, even the history of its development in one volume. It's really a great book to get in your hands. But guys, as you think about, because when I was a student at University of Houston in the late 80s, I heard some of these things. Now, I didn't hear the term critical theory, but some of the things I came to, but it was always in obscure things, maybe in an obscure class, a kind of a level 201 psychology class, I'd hear some of these things that now I look back on and know where it came from. But it was all very much confined to the academy and to theorizing and to discussion in that way. None of it ever seemed mainstreamable, if you like, at all at that time. And of course, when it broke, and I think you're absolutely right, the lab leak, which I think is a great way to put it, was the some of these events in the last few years. But it had been kind of the playground of certain academics in certain departments of university world. But it came across the ocean to Columbia University, because most of the scholars from the Frankfurt School moved, because most of them were Jewish and they got out of Nazi Germany. They come over to Columbia. Columbia makes a house for them, and suddenly it gets into the American Academy, where it just kind of stays. But during this time, it's advancing across the academy, right? And ultimately, those ideas don't stay in the classroom. Ultimately, they get into the society. And I wonder if there were key moments before this most effective lab leak over the last 5, 6, 7 years, where there's some key moments in the 20th century that marked its at least in some ways, its introduction into mainstream thinking, if that makes sense.
Sure, it does. And just to emphasize that in the book, we address a lot of these myths about critical theory, critical race theory. And one of them is that it's just a legal field, this esoteric, abstract legal discipline, and it's not true. So And they'll say that themselves. So in their seminal text, Critical Race Theory and Introduction, Richard Delgado and Jean Stefanchik write that in 2017, they're speculating about the future of CRT. And they say that one possibility is that it becomes, quote, the new civil rights orthodoxy. It just becomes so suffuses and dominates our culture that it's taken for granted. And they even say in 2017, they say this may in fact already be happening. So they're open about the fact that it is everywhere. And even that was 6-7 years ago now. But major events, I would say one big turning point is the publication in 1995 of a paper called Towards a Critical Race Theory of Education by Ladson, Billings, and Tate. Because between 89 and 95, CRT was mainly done by legal scholars. But in 95, it was injected into education. It made a huge splash there. So that was what, oh my gosh, 30 years ago. So think about the fact that CRT is now, research is, I say, more prevalent in education and pedagogy than even in law. What that means is that 3 decades worth of teachers have been trained in this framework for thinking about everything from education to race, to classroom policy, to healthcare, to discipline, to criminal justice. And so when you say, oh, it's only in academia, well, academia is now K through 12 through college through postgrad. So the kids that are coming through this pipeline, it's in the water. It's in their daily classroom practice being taught by their elementary school teachers. And that's why it's, I think, really influenced our culture. And that was a big watershed event. Pat, what do you think?
Well, and I would mention along those lines that Neil and I aren't standing outside the field looking at this. With my PhD life, and in my faculty life, I'm in the field. And in fact, I've taught in our School of Education at my university, and we teach a course that is designed to bring K through 12 teachers into touch with the critical tradition. And we teach in that course, critical race theory is taught. And some of the texts that we mentioned in our book are used in that course, for instance. So the K through 12 educators that are getting their certificate of teaching and their undergraduate degree in School of Education across the country are getting introduced to the critical tradition. And this is putting critical pedagogy really into the hands of K through 12 educators. And there will be downstream perspectives that are communicated to second graders, third graders, fifth graders, eighth graders. This is not something that we're making up. It is an absolute dynamic. And Kimberly Crenshaw, who really, you know, is founder of critical race theory, speaks about this as well, the gains on the ground relative to K through education. And so not just that stakeholder, though, in terms of the traveling of the critical tradition is really across many academic fields. And then because of that, even business, for instance, I teach public relations. And in one of the texts that I use in that marketing public relations class speaks about social justice issues in the context of corporate life. And and so the ideas that permeate the critical tradition can adapt easily to a range of different hosts, so to speak, in terms of where it will galvanize and hunker down and also begin to grow and be influential. And I would also just mention that identity politics is about power tracking with identity, with social locations, ethnic location. And this has become more and more hip and in vogue and more less embarrassing than it used to be to identify as someone who's pro-identity politics. This has become more and more popular in our day, and critical social theory is about power and how it's manifested relative to identity. So it's a perfect storm in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Interesting when you think of historical roots. I mean, the popular response from the right has been to dismiss critical theory as cultural Marxism. And yet, you even see this in the Frankfurt School, and Neil, we were emailing about my manuscript on precisely this point. You also see Nietzsche in critical theory, Nietzsche's war against categories seems to me to be profoundly influential. You know, Michel Foucault is the obvious transmitter of Nietzsche, I suspect, to critical theory broadly considered. To what extent, then, do you think that, you know, I am suspicious of the dismissal of critical theory as cultural Marxism on the grounds that it sounds to me like a rhetorical soundbite that's a cheap discrediting of what is a relatively sophisticated approach that deserves a more sophisticated refutation. Don't let the listeners think here I'm advocating critical theory. I'm just concerned that the characterization of it as cultural Marxism is too cheap a shot to actually make any significant damage.
Yeah, we talk about... Go ahead.
Pat. I was just going to say quickly, and Neil, you can follow up. Carl, you're exactly right. It's false to make a one-to-one conflation against with critical social theory and Marxism. You know, critical theory in the Frankfurt School, historic critical theory, is both a pushback and an amendment and expansion of Marxism. And then critical social theory today manifested in a number of critical social theories like critical pedagogy, critical race theory, queer theory, post-colonialism, and so forth, is both an expansion and an amendment to historic critical theory. So while Marxism is a substrate that runs underneath all of critical theory and critical social theory to an extent, it is wrong to make a one-to-one correspondence between the two. And then cultural Marxism has been co-opted and captivated by a number of white power, white nationalist groups. And then, you know, words are on the move. You know, words, linguistic scholars will tell you that, you know, words don't keep a singular definition forever. And so cultural Marxism now has been front-loaded and loaded with a lot of ideas that would actually work against critical social theory in certain ways. So, and Neil, you may want to add to that. But.
Yeah, I was just going to say that in the book, we talk about the danger of sort of simplistic refutations of these ideas, like, oh, it's just cultural Marxism, it's just woke. What does that even mean? You know, we try to zero in on the ideas, because what we found is that when we try to engage people and convince them these are very dangerous ideas, they should not be adopted by Christians, when we do that, they often will assume that we're working at a very elementary, basic, or even a misunderstanding of critical theory. So you have to raise the level of discourse to say, no, actually, we know what we're talking about. And we're not attacking labels. We're not just calling you Marxists. We're saying these ideas are poisonous. I don't care what you call them, whether you call them cultural Marxism, whether you call them postmodernism, whether you call them whatever you want. The ideas themselves are the poison. And we have to root them out of the church and society, too. And our book tries to make these what sound like very complicated ideas accessible to the layperson, explain terminology. What does equity mean? What does intersectionality actually mean? And we quote extensively from the theorists themselves to show you that we're not inventing these ideas. We're not strawmanning them. This is really what they're saying. And you could pretty clearly, after a few chapters, you say, yeah, this is really antithetical to Christianity.
And that's what I wanted to kind of follow up with you. Guys, in the PCA, the denomination I'm a pastor in, over the last several years, we've been dealing with some of this. I mean, I've sat in gatherings, a couple of large, significant gatherings of PCA pastors where I've seen men advocate by name critical race theory, that we need to draw on the insights and the wisdom of critical race theory, da 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 da. Now, that's not widespread in the PCA, but enough lay people in the PCA have heard those kinds of things. And I'm contacted by members of PCA churches around the country who hear some of the categories. They've done enough reading to know some of the key words and some of the key ideas, and they've heard some of it in some of the preaching in some of the churches. So I wonder if you all could just kind of do what would be kind of the fundamental presuppositions of critical theory in general, and how that is incongruent with the gospel. In other words, this isn't an issue of take the meat and just spit out the bones. The situation's worse than that.
Definitely is. I mean, there's so many ways. This is why we have, you know, four chapters devoted to
the exactly. But the things that kind of come to the top of the surface here, are the key things that the Christians who are wanting to be discerning on this, mm-hmm. you know, what are some of the key kind of presuppositions and how that conflicts with biblical Christianity? What would you say?
Sure. So I'll reel off a few. One is the redefinition of the word oppression. So critical theorists have redefined the word oppression to include not just tyranny and unjust treatment and control, but to include all the ways that the ruling class, whether it's whites or men or heterosexuals or Christians, impose their values on culture. That's a form of oppression, according to the new definition. Well, and oftentimes you'll hear phrases like, well, people of color are oppressed today. And they kind of, yeah, of course, clap, clap, yeah, snap, snap. But wait a minute. You've redefined the word oppression there because, again, most people of color don't walk around under tyranny and being abused and people are burning. No. So when you say that phrase, you're implicitly saying that, well, they're living in a system with these subtle forms of power that's shaping their lived experiences. Well, okay, but take that same definition of oppression and apply it to, say, women or to LGBTQ people or to gender fluid people, because they're also, in these same terms, living under these systems of influence and value that marginalize them, make them feel othered. Now, wait a minute. So suddenly you get to the notion of what's called the social binary, that all society can be divided into oppressors and oppressed groups along lines of race, class, gender, sexuality. But as Christians, we can't say, well, heterosexism is oppressive. Well, no, because there is an actually absolute objective value that's God ordained that says, no, heterosexuality is good. It's natural. And, or the gender binary is not oppressive. It is God's idea. So it's one example of how we can accept a poor definition of oppression without knowing it, that bleeds into our views of everything from race, but also then to class, gender, sexuality, gender identity, physical ability, religion. So same idea. Critical theorists, we quote them as saying that evangelism is oppressive because you're imposing your narrative of truth, the dominant one, the Judeo-Christian one, onto these marginalized groups like Hindus and Muslims and atheists in our culture. And so therefore, if you really want to be anti-oppressive, you have to stop evangelizing.
Right.
So that's just, again, one example among many of ways in which the basic outlook of critical theory, critical race theory, they're all just not compatible with Christianity. Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to adopt critical race theory and then cordon it off from queer theory. You know, well, I won't go there. That's very difficult to do that, isn't it? And remain intellectually consistent. In other words, if you're going to buy in to critical race theory, it's very difficult to remain intellectually consistent and reject queer theory.
I mean,
correct. One of the
impossible.
It's impossible because one of the primary themes and tenets and characteristics of critical race theory is this notion of interlocking systems of oppression, mm-hmm. where if you're going to be a genuine critical race theorist, if you're going to really adopt critical race theory, then you also have to adopt the campaign of other marginalized groups along other axes of marginalization, not just race. So now we have to think about sexuality and gender. And so if you're going to be truly anti-racist, if you're going to be truly pushing back against racism the way critical race theory underscores that you should, then you're also going to have to embrace the ideological standpoint and perspectives of the gay community, of the queer community, because they also have been oppressed by hegemonic power, and you must take up their cause of emancipation and liberation. And now you're really running into problems like Neil alluded to. Heteronormativity is actually a societal good.
Right.
It is something that is ultimately tethered to biblical epistemology. But queer theory would say, no, we must reject heteronormativity and embrace that is actually a societal construct that is oppressive. So now, as a critical race theorist, because this is part of critical race theory, now you're running afoul of God's sexual ethics. And there's a host of reasons why that critical social theory isn't compatible with biblical epistemology, a host. With that said, we're not superstitious. We do acknowledge that there are things that critical social theory gets right and happens to be true. And that just means that ultimately those truths are find their way back to God. You know, if something is actually truly true, then, well, it's part of God's truth. And it doesn't matter its secondary or tertiary epistemological locations. But as a robust meta-narrative worldview, critical social theory and its expansive expressions is categorically against biblical Christianity. And one thing that I would just mention, lived experience is so valorized in critical social theory. Right. It becomes an epistemological pathway. How do we know what is true? Well, if you're a part of a minoritized group, your lived experience, according to critical social theory, gives you special insight, standpoint epistemology, special insight into social analysis because you have been in an oppressed state. Well, that's just not true, biblically speaking. It may give you some insight that someone who's never been oppressed could benefit from, but the idea that it makes you somehow discerning to the point that other voices that now have been considered to be oppressive need to sit down and not speak and not contribute. Well, now you've entered into something that is way north of just something that lived experience can offer. You've actually created a rubric to understand social analysis that is false and spurious.
It's interesting.
And then when you now apply that lived experience to how you're thinking about scripture, it becomes eisegesis. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to use my ethnic or social location as a way to see the world and now the way to see and understand the text of scripture, well, now I'm layering on a lens that will lead to heterodoxy.
Yeah.
Yes, it raises an interesting question, of course, that if your lived experience is such that only you can experience it, if you're part of the group, can you actually communicate it to any other group? You know, right. Can I read your words and know what on earth you're talking about? But I also think that this is why critical race theory is the perfect Trojan horse for this in the church, because, you know, no Christian wants to be a racist.
That's right.
I say to the students in class, hey, you know, I don't want to be a racist. Nobody wants to be known as a racist, but the problem is that critical race theory sets the terms of the game at that point. And once you, as Neil and Pat have just pointed out, once you accept the rules of that game, the question becomes, where are the limits of the rule of that game? And when I did my thing at First Things on evangelicals and race, you know, the question I asked in that, which nobody ever answered amongst all the deluge of hate mail I had, nobody actually answered the question. I'm most open to being incompetent, but I want my question answered, is why or how on earth do you object to the LGBTQ movement having accepted the premises that you accept for critical race theory? Right. I may be an idiot. I may know nothing about critical race theory, in which case it should be relatively straightforward and easy to answer that question.
Yeah.
The fact that nobody bothered to answer that question allows me, I think, to have, I think, what Catholics would call moral certainty about the reason. Yeah, and it seems to me that, yeah, this whole power dynamic is something that Christians need to be acutely aware of. And that's why this book, I think, is so very important. You know, again, plug it to the audience. This is a book for definitely for pastors and elders, but yes, I would say any thoughtful Christian to get hold of. Critical Dilemma by Neil Shenvey and Pat Sawyer. Buy a copy and read it.
Indeed. And that brings us to a perfect invitation to those of you that are listening. If you will go to our website, mortificationofspin.org, you can enter to win a copy of this excellent book, Critical Dilemma, The Rise of Critical Theories and Social Justice Ideology, Implications for the Church and Society. It is an excellent book. It is readable. It is thorough. You will find it very helpful. And as Carl said, any literate layperson can pick up this book and benefit greatly from it. It's clear that the authors were very careful about not writing something that would be confined to the academy, but they want it in the hands of lay people, and it reads that way. So I highly commend it to you. It's a book that we have in the book area of the church I serve, and we'll continue to keep it stocked because people I know across my church are having to deal with these things. People who are in corporate settings, people who work at hospitals, teachers, students, they're all having to deal with this stuff. And so they're trying to understand it. This is a great book to get in your hands. And so please go to our website, enter to win a copy. And if you're not one of the fortunate winners, then get on Amazon and buy it. We commend it to you. And our thanks go out to Neil and Patrick for their excellent work on this. And of course, this is just a long line of work they've been doing for a number of years on the subject. And we're grateful for their labors in that regard. And of course, I'm sure they can both tell you that they've received no attacks or criticism because of their work on this. Everybody has just been sweetness and light to them because of that.
Sunshine puppies. Nothing but.
That's right. So again, thanks to our guests.
From all sides, in fact.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So again, thanks to our guests. Go to our website, enter to win a copy of the book, and we will look forward to being with you all next time on Mortification of Spin.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Mortification of Spin, a podcast of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. For more on topics like this, visit mortificationofspin.org, where you can find other articles by Carl and Todd, browse the archive of past episodes, and make a donation. We'll talk to you next time on Mortification of Spin.